1948, just as the Italian people were busy casting their votes in elections, the CIA planned a secret operation. The operation had a clear effect on the election. Communism loses the election. Stalin is still stunned by the election results, which makes the situation more complicated for him. It was really painful for the Soviet leader. Czechoslovakia, the only democratic government in Eastern Europe, attempted a coup that year. Developments and the suspicious death of the Czechoslovak foreign minister, Jan Masaryk, sends a clear message to the communist opposition. Other Europeans all know that any opposition to Stalin's sphere of influence will eventually result in a Masaryk-style repression. Eastern Europeans are all horrified by Stalin's policies, all but one country, Yugoslavia. Josip Broz Tito, the communist leader of Yugoslavia, came to power on his own and does not need Stalin to stay in power. He is a danger to the Soviet government these days. Tito seems to have gotten bored with Stalin's policies due to Cominform's insistence. He has made a serious decision to cut off his country's relations with Moscow. Tito finally does it a year later. Although Stalin's indifference on this issue is a bit mysterious, is there anyone in the Soviet Union who does not know that the incident can send a shockwave through the communist pillars? Stalin has become confused. Moscow has not yet recovered when it was reported that the Soviet leader had taken military action. Berlin, the capital of Germany, was sieged. In the war that took several years, everyone already understood that if neutral Germany gradually tilts toward the Soviets, the Cold War in Europe will be in favor of the communists. But if the opposite happens and Germany moves towards the US, things will get much worse for the Soviet Union. A part of Germany fell into the hands of the Americans that was considered the richest and most developed part of Europe. If the US wants, it can easily turn the region into a powder keg to attack the Soviet Union. Therefore, Stalin should move more cautiously against Germany. Stalin, who thinks the solution is to lay a siege on Berlin, makes the US Army spring into action. They deliver food and other necessities to the besieged city by building an air bridge. Berlin appreciates the move. The Westerners are now a friendly face in the eyes of the German people, as opposed to Stalin, who now has a wild and powerless image in front of the world. The US government gradually takes over the communists. Meanwhile, the Soviet government has no idea that Truman was up in arms to shatter their ideology. In November 1947, a plan was prepared by the Joint Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army called Broiler. The main goal of the plan was to destroy the Soviet Union's ability to wage a war using massive atomic bombardment. The plan considers 34 atomic bombs against 24 Soviet cities at a time the medical reports from the experiments conducted on the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan's atomic bombing are still on Truman's desk. Truman knows very well what consequences await the Soviet Union. However, he prefers to continue sipping his French coffee at his desk and run up and down the report statistics. 2 years later, when over 200 atomic bombs and 20 bombers were prepared for the operation, Truman met with some military experts. They believe that if the U.S. fails to prevent atomic bombing, the bombs may not be effective enough to destroy the Soviet Union's ability to fight. At this time, Truman receives a recommendation from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which makes him think about finding a solution. The Joint Chief of Staff believes the U.S. forces cannot defend Western Europe against the communists, even if they use the atomic bomb. Truman must come up with a proper solution. Broiler's plan fails to achieve the objective. Two years later, it was reported that the Soviet Union had tested its first atomic bomb. American scientists start thinking harder. The issue is slowly turning into an arms race. A little later, a group of American nuclear scientists solved Truman's problem in the major war, a thermonuclear bomb or superbomb. Estimates say the new technology can cause an explosion that no one dares tell Truman about the consequences. The only thing everyone is thinking about now is only one thing, not falling behind the Soviet nuclear industry. In the fall of 1948, Truman begins a new chapter of his negotiations with Western European countries. Western Europe is now ready to cooperate with the White House after the implementation of the Marshall Plan in their countries and receiving economic aid from the U.S. The main objective of discussion in Truman's negotiations with Western European countries is a formal treaty of alliance against communist Soviets. Truman finally forms his international union. NATO is the title the European countries now must line up for membership in. In April 1949, the NATO Treaty was signed in Washington by 10 European countries, as well as the U.S. and Canada. The contents of the treaty, which were published, put Stalin in a bind. One, if one NATO member country is attacked, all members will provide it with military support. Two, NATO members are committed to cooperating in various military fields, including intelligence exchange, military training, and joint exercises. And three, NATO members should use similar equipment and weapons to facilitate their military cooperation. It is 1955. It's been 2 years since Stalin died. Some news spreads in the world. The news terrifies the Soviet Union. West Germany has joined NATO.
Now we welcome to our company the Federal Republic of Germany, represented here by its great statesman, Dr. Adenauer.
The emergence of a militaristic Germany determined to reunify could be a wake-up call for the Soviet Union that has already been invaded by Germany. During the last days of Stalin's rule, when the political and economic situation in Eastern Europe had deteriorated, his successor, Nikita Khrushchev, must seriously pursue reconstruction and improvement of the situation in Eastern Europe. During these years, East Germany is not doing well. Since 1951, suppression of private businesses by the government, forced membership in collective farms, dissatisfaction with the communist system, and the desire to live in the economic prosperity of the West have driven some East German residents from this region to West Germany. As his first moves, the new Soviet leader resumes ties with Tito. Khrushchev is not happy with Stalin's measures. Yugoslavia resigns the Fraternity Pact with the Soviet Union. But the troubled situation in East Germany and West Germany's accession to NATO will still be big problems for Khrushchev. Khrushchev must find a solution. So he decides to drag seven Eastern European countries to the Warsaw Pact. Dubbed a military alliance, the treaty commits communist countries of Eastern Europe to help each other in the event of an armed attack by the West. Now Europe is divided into two armed groups, the West under NATO and the East under Warsaw. Following these agreements, Soviet tanks were deployed to East Germany in 1953, Hungary in 1956, and Czechoslovakia in 1968 to crack down on anti-communist movements. Although the evidence suggests that NATO is an alliance of sovereign states, the Warsaw Pact appears to be an imperialist enterprise of puppet regimes under the complete domination of Moscow. Now, Western narratives and propaganda have touched on this fundamental difference. However, while NATO insists on introducing itself as a defense association, everyone gradually gets suspicious due to its actions. In 1960, the U.S. proposes a plan called Multilateral Force. The plan seeks to create a navy consisting of ballistic missile submarines and warships with international crews from NATO member states. Military equipment, all of which are armed with ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads. In 1985, something happens in the Soviet Union which shakes the very foundations of communism. Mikhail Gorbachev becomes the leader of the Soviet Union. Gorbachev's economic reforms gradually drag the Soviet Union into serious economic problems. The severe shortage of food resources turns supporters of communism into vocal dissidents. Gorbachev's slogans take Western shape. Although he commemorates communist leaders when he leads Soviet Union towards democracy and the free world, he is praised by the Western media. He gets overwhelmed by the Western encouragements. The so-called reforms by Gorbachev not only do not solve the Soviets' problems, but also lead to the collapse and fragmentation of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, with all of its violations and evils, at least its geographical scope, could be a defense barrier against the expansionism of Westerners. After the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, the U.S. removes its biggest enemy and the Cold War ends. The U.S. government, which promised Gorbachev that NATO will not advance even an inch towards Russia, in no time it forgets its promise. The promise is going to get the allies of communism involved. The story now reaches Yugoslavia.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Washington Attorney General Nick Brown joined with Oregon in filing a lawsuit against President Donald Trump's effort to impose new election procedures on the states. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. The American newspaper, the Seattle Times, has covered the story and tells us more. Washington's Attorney General Nick Brown filed a lawsuit on Friday, 4th of April, against President Donald Trump's attempt to alter election procedures across the United States, challenging what he described as an unconstitutional and illegal attack on democracy. Washington teamed with Oregon to file the lawsuit, which is similar to the one filed on Thursday, 3rd of April, by California and 18 other states, according to Washington Attorney General Nick Brown. The legal actions are directed at an executive order by Donald Trump last week that calls for requiring people to provide documentary proof of citizenship when registering to vote and for mail-in ballots to be received by elections office no later than Election Day. The Washington-Oregon lawsuit was filed in U.S. District Court in Seattle, Washington. Neither the Constitution nor any federal law gives the president the power to set rules for how states conduct elections, Nick Brown said during a news conference at his downtown Seattle office. Only the Constitution and congressional action can change how states handle voting, he said. The president has absolutely no authority to do what he's purporting to do, Nick Brown added. He was joined at the news conference by Washington Secretary of State Steve Hobbs and State Representative Charlotte Mina. Nick Brown added, "We will not let this attempt to assert control over our constitutional rights go unchecked. It is highly important that we fight these efforts and not become numb to tyranny." The Washington-Oregon lawsuit says Donald Trump's order violates multiple provisions of the Constitution, including the Elections Clause, saying the clause gives states primary authority to regulate the time, place, and manner of federal elections. The lawsuit says President Trump's order also violates multiple federal laws, including the National Voter Registration Act of 1993, which says people can attest to their U.S. citizenship when registering to vote. Reacting to the lawsuit filed by California and other states, White House spokesperson Harrison Fields defended President Trump's proof of citizenship order as common sense and called objections by Democratic leaders insane. The Trump administration is standing up for free, fair, and honest elections, Harrison Fields said. Trump's 25th of March executive order builds on his long-standing complaints about U.S. elections, including his false claims on widespread voter fraud and voting machine manipulation in his 2020 loss to Democrat Joe Biden. In his 2024 presidential campaign, Donald Trump claimed there would be rampant fraud, but he has been mostly quiet on that front since his victory. Nick Brown said Washington and Oregon decided to sue on their own rather than join Thursday's lawsuit, partly because the Pacific Northwest states have similar mail-in systems that could be uniquely affected by President Trump's agenda. Washington's voting system is already secure, fair, and particularly accessible, Hobbs said on Friday, 4th of April. Trump's election order, if carried through, could disenfranchise hundreds of thousands of voters here, especially older adults, low-income voters, and naturalized citizens, according to Washington's Secretary of State. Hobbs added, let's be clear, federal law already prohibits non-citizens from voting. Every voter in our state must attest to their citizenship, and we regularly maintain our voter rolls. Registering to vote in Washington, if you're not a citizen, is a felony, punishable by up to 5 years imprisonment. Registration requires a driver's license or state-issue ID card, and without either of those, one can register by using a Social Security number. Many states, including Washington and Oregon, accept ballots postmarked on or before Election Day, including when they are received in the mail after Election Day. The mail-in process has helped Washington achieve one of the country's best voter participation rates, according to Attorney General Nick Brown. Washington is now part of 11 lawsuits against the Trump administration, according to Nick Brown. Brown predicted that at this rate, there will be many more to come. The national broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story. Washington and Oregon on Friday, 4th of April, became the latest states to ask a court to reject President Donald Trump's efforts to overhaul elections in the United States, just a day after Democratic officials in 19 other states filed a similar lawsuit. Washington Attorney General Nick Brown added, neither the Constitution nor any federal law gives the president authority to set rules for how states conduct elections. Nick Brown, a Democrat, speaking at a news conference in Seattle, said, it is the states that decide how voters are registered. It is the states that decide how ballots are counted. Friday, 4th of April's lawsuit in U.S. District Court in Seattle is the fifth against the executive order since it was issued last week. The order includes new requirements that people provide documentary proof of citizenship when registering to vote and a demand that all mail ballots be received by Election Day. It also puts states' federal funding at risk if election officials don't comply. That could disenfranchise hundreds of thousands of voters in the Pacific Northwest of the United States, where ballots must be postmarked but not necessarily received by Election Day. Washington Secretary of State Steve Hobbs noted at a news conference that more than 300,000 ballots in Washington arrived after Election Day last year. Steve Hobbs added, President Trump's executive order is nothing more than a blatant attempt to rig the system and suppress votes. Oregon's Attorney General Dan Rayfield, speaking at a news conference, said, Trump is trying to make it harder for people to vote. It's a direct assault on the Constitution and a brazen attempt to act like a king, dictating how states should run their elections. The lawsuits from the states follow earlier ones against the executive order by nonprofit voting groups and the Democratic National Committee, the DNC. They say the order could disenfranchise voters because millions of eligible voting age Americans do not have the proper documents readily available. People already are required to attest to being U.S. citizens under penalty of perjury in order to vote. The lawsuits have said Donald Trump's directive violates the Constitution, which specifies that states have the authority to set the times, places, and manner of elections. The U.S. Congress has the power to make or alter regulations for elections for president and Congress, but the Constitution doesn't mention any presidential authority over election administration. White House spokesperson Harrison Fields on Friday, 4th of April, called the proof of citizenship requirements common sense and said the administration is standing up for free, fair, and honest elections. President Trump has continued to claim that he won the 2020 election despite all evidence to the contrary. Courts of law have rejected dozens of his legal challenges, and his attorney general at the time said there was no sign of widespread voter fraud. Reviews, recounts, and audits in the battleground states where he contested his loss all confirmed that Democrat Joe Biden won the election. He and other Republicans also promoted the idea during last year's presidential election that large numbers of people who were not U.S. citizens actually voted. Voting by non-citizens is rare in the United States and, when caught, can lead to felony charges and even deportation. Washington Attorney General Nick Brown said it is hard to imagine a subject where this president has less credibility than he does with elections. Nick Brown cited Trump's lies about the 2020 presidential election and his loss to Joe Biden. He added, he's always looking to undermine faith in our democracy.
Economic Divide.
Years of wars and mismanagement can bring destruction to various sectors of a country's economy, especially if the devastation has ruined the electric infrastructure. This would be one way to control a country's advancement, such as the case when it comes to Iraq. Yet Iran has stepped in as a neighbor to provide Iraq with its electric needs, albeit at a cost. In the name of maximum pressure on Iran, the U.S. has ended the sanctions waiver that would facilitate Iran providing electricity to Iraq. It couldn't come at a worse time. Right before the hot summer months, the U.S. has ended the sanctions waiver which would provide electricity to Iraq from Iran. The U.S. has many reasons for this move, including putting pressure on Iraq to stop in its business dealings with Iran. Coming up in today's program, U.S. sanctions waiver ends for Iraq. The U.S. has ended the sanctions waiver, taking into account the type of damage that may incur on Iraqis, especially right before the dry, hot summer months. Is this done on purpose? U.S. is squeezing with both Iran and Iraq with maximum pressure. The U.S. believes this is a win-win situation for both of them, applying pressure on both countries. Yet Iraqis will be the ones suffering, not to mention the businesses that have to deal with electricity shutdowns and Iraq's electricity crisis due to U.S. wars. The U.S. wars on Iraq has led to destruction of the electricity grid in Iraq, a problem Iraq has now had for decades. This problem even existed during the former dictator Saddam era, but the U.S. hasn't helped rebuilding Iraq's energy. Now we're going to be discussing that and a whole lot more with our guest, Nabil Al-Tikriti, professor of Middle East History at the University of Mary Washington, and Shakil Ahmad Rameh, CEO of Asian Institute of Eco-Civilization Research and Development.
Thank you for having me on the show. The new second Trump administration last week ended the sanctions waiver that allowed Iraq to import electricity directly from Iran so that they will no longer be able to do so. At this point, they must therefore generate that electricity themselves. What they did not waive, apparently, was another waiver, a similar waiver, that allowed Iraq to import natural gas from Iran, which accounts for 43% of Iraq's natural gas imports. So the question in the future is, what will Iraq be able to do in terms of natural gas imports to power its own electrical power grid if either one or both of those aspects are completely cut off due to U.S. sanctions? One thing I will point out is that these are U.S. sanctions, not international sanctions. There's always a potential difference between what the U.S. says and what the EU says, especially in today's world where the U.S. has basically set out on a new policy that, in effect, makes enemies of everyone.
It's good to add this breakdown to the comments made by our guest, Nabil Al-Tikriti, who made a differentiation on how the U.S. ending the sanctions waiver does not include the gas that Iran provides Iraq, which contributes to over 40% of Iraq's electricity. Here you can also see the other sources of energy for Iraq. When it comes to Iraq's electricity needs, the demand far outstrips the supply, as displayed here, in terms of the amount of electricity that is needed, measured in gigawatts. This has been the ongoing, persistent problem that Iraq has faced, relying on Iran to only partially help with its electricity needs.
This could be extremely damaging for the Iraqi consumer, especially in the short term. It is possible that it won't be so bad because Iraq has been trying to diversify its energy imports throughout the last few years, because at a certain point they realized that they were over-reliant on Iranian sources. They're not there yet. They're not even close to being there yet. And if recent summers are any indication, there's going to be a serious need for power generation in the middle of the summer, and they're not yet on their way to being able to make up any shortfall in Iranian importation.
There's no electricity. My TV, refrigerator, and air cooler are all off, so we just sit on the balcony to enjoy ourselves.
Iraq has sort of a menu of things that it might try to do. One is they could try to diversify their energy sources. And from what I can see, there's talk of Qatar being one substitution, Oman being another substitution, even Turkmenistan being another substitution. And they announced that they were planning to double imports of electricity from Turkey, although that announcement actually came before the new Trump administration announcement.
This is the social media section of the program. It is extremely deplorable that the U.S. administration has decided to target the innocent people of Iraq by attempting to deprive them of access to basic services such as electricity, especially ahead of the coming hot months of the year. Iraq generates half of its electricity from natural gas. Much of this gas is imported, especially from Iran. If the U.S. sanctions hit this trade, Iraq could lose much of its power supply. Bad news with the summer heat underway. The head of the finance committee in the Iraqi parliament, Atwan Al-Atwani, sent a letter to the U.S. government stating that stopping the import of gas from Iran will cause the collapse of the electricity grid system during the coming summer in Iraq. What is the fault of the Iraqi people that their electricity has been cut off due to the imposition of sanctions on Iran? The American government has not allowed Iraq to contract with any company building power plants, including major American companies.
The US and its allies did not invest on building the power infrastructure in Iraq. Although Iraq is a very resource-rich country, it has vast resources of the fossil fuels which can be used to generate power. But unfortunately, the US and allied forces did not invest on constructing the power infrastructure. They have destroyed the vast majority of infrastructure during the invasion of Iraq. And as a price, the people are paying the price, and they have to buy the gas from the other country or the power from the other country. Although Iran is trying to accommodate Iraq and concentrate in its response, but unfortunately, still Iraq have to import the gas, which has a bad, or you can say negative consequences for its economy and for the welfare of the people in the long run.
Iraq's reliance on Iranian energy is outlined here from the years 2010 through 2023. What is significant here is twofold. One, Iranian supply to Iraq has actually decreased as the years have gone by, the average medium being around 7% of Iraq's electricity needs. This is due to a variety of problems, but it shows that Iran has tried to accommodate Iraq while providing electricity to its own population.
U.S. have must realize that they know it. The problem is that they don't want to act on it. Their objectives, their geopolitical objectives, or their hegemonic behavior is telling them if you have to control Iraq, you have to bring Iraq on its knees. And the best way is to control its power supply. U.S. and its allies, they are trying to control that power sector so they can bring Iraq on its knees and compel Iraq to obey what US want. Maybe they wanted Iraq to act as a vassal state, to act against the regional countries including Iran, Saudi Arabia or other countries, or they want to use Iraq as a base for a terrorist activity in the region and beyond the region. The US and their allies, who always talk about the human rights, they have the least regard for the human rights, or even for the human lives. They are just using these slogans just to create a smoke screen to justify their action in the different parts of the world.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
This is the info news section of the program. Germany, Europe. Germany has dealt a death blow to the euro. Eurozone stability is under threat due to Berlin's military spending boost and debt brake overhaul. A law has been passed to create a 500 billion euros or $547 billion infrastructure fund. Next, super Chinese processor. China unveils processor a million times faster than its U.S. rival. The chip has vastly outperformed Google's Sycharome chip. And in Bloomberg, it was reported in October 2023 that Chinese companies and institutions applied for over 29,000 AI-related patents in 2022, compared to 29,000 in the previous year. The figure is nearly 80% more than U.S. filings. Now, U.S. stock market crash. Why are Trump supporters claiming he wants to crash the U.S. stock market? Some MAGA followers are spreading an unsubstantiated theory related to the cost of the U.S. national debt. He's trying to make it easier to pay off the U.S.'s $36 trillion national debt by lowering interest rates. The U.S. government last year spent more than $1 trillion on interest payments alone. And lira plunges. Istanbul Mayor Imamoglu's arrest has caused havoc for Turkey, its president, and its economy. The Turkish lira has plunged to record low. The lira has fallen 2.6% after earlier falling of 12.7% to a record low. Stocks down near 9%, the largest daily drop in 4 years. Analysts worry about the effect on monetary policy. This is the in-depth section of the program. This isn't the case of a country needing energy. It's a case of how another country has destroyed its sovereignty and independence. The proof is in the wars that U.S. has executed against Iraq. The genesis of Iraq's electricity crisis can be traced back to the Persian Gulf War in 1991. The country's strategic power plants were targeted for destruction by the U.S.-led international coalition forces, and the U.S. sanctions that followed thwarted any attempts at rehabilitation. This left Iraq's infrastructure and industries in ruin and subjected its citizens to unbearable conditions during sweltering summers. Between 2003 and 2021, Iraq poured a bewildering $85 billion into its struggling electricity sector. The situation is bleak after 2 decades, numerous contracts, and tens of billions of dollars spent. Iraq still falls short of acquiring more than a third of its electric power requirements. More than $100 billion has been spent to solve Iraq's electricity crisis, and the spending continues to no avail. Now our guest rejoins us, Mr. Nabil Al-Tikriti, Professor of Middle East History at the University of Mary Washington. Nabil, my question for you is this. The U.S. was responsible for ruining a large portion of Iraq's infrastructure through the wars, like the 2003 war, yet did not assist to help restore the power grids in any way, despite spending more than $50 billion since 2003 in Iraq. Official Iraqi, British, and American statements, as well as special reports, justify power outages. What is your take on that?
Well, one thing I should point out is that the damage to the Iraqi electric grid and the damage to Iraq's own domestic energy supply really dates all the way back to 1991 with the what Americans call the first Gulf War. And the U.S. Did a lot of damage to the Iraqi power sector directly through air bombings in that war. But then they also largely prevented Iraq from fixing their own power sector due to sanctions throughout the 1990s. And what I distinctly remember, because I lived in Iraq in the early 90s, is that at first it wasn't such a big problem, and then it gradually, throughout the 90s, became a bigger and bigger problem. By 2003, the Iraqi government was on a regular schedule of rotating power cuts, and in effect, One neighborhood would be off for 4 hours in the middle of the day, and then another neighborhood might be off in the early evening for 4 hours, and then another neighborhood might be off in the middle of the night, and they had a very strict system of rotations. Then when the U.S. invaded in 2003, they planned to spend $50 billion to rebuild the entire Iraqi economy, especially the power industry. However, that never really came to fruition due to a number of factors. One factor is that the Iraqi insurgency at the time would destroy almost anything that the Americans would build, so that there was a lot of destruction back then, and they were never able to really rebuild the sector. Fast forward to the 2010s and now the 2020s, the Iraqi governments themselves have tried to rebuild it, still with very mixed results. From what I understand, the situation has recently improved from an Iraqi power perspective in that they are gradually improving the delivery of electricity to every household in Iraq. But I believe that may be due to Iran's assistance.
A government advisor specializing in energy affairs estimates that some $35 billion has been squandered on futile investments within the country's electricity sector. This deficiency has led to agonizingly prolonged power outages lasting up to a grueling 8 to 12 hours each day, especially during the scorching summer months. Iran has alleviated a big part of that burden by exporting 7.3 gigawatts of electricity to Iraq monthly, while GE, Siemens, and their affiliated companies were contracted to provide an additional 27.7 gigawatts toward the reaching the coveted 35 gigawatt. But their combined efforts have failed to stabilize Iraq's electricity needs, even partially, especially since Iraq's power outages have been consistently increasing both in time and occurrences. Our guest, Ahmad Ramey, CEO of Asian Institute of Eco-Civilization, rejoins us. Ahmad, let's take a look at General Electric's role in Iraq's energy crisis. The U.S. energy giant holds a grip over Iraqi energy matters. Since the U.S. invasion, Iraq has spent $85 billion on its electricity sector, but it still faces 12-hour daily power outages. So why is GE and Siemens, for that matter, still getting contracts they won't fulfill?
I think they did it on purpose. The investment you are talking about of $50 billion U.S. dollar, I don't have their breakdown, so where they have invested or not, but my hunch feeling is that most of the money will be spent at the name of security to import the security apparatus and the arms from the U.S. and their allies. They will be invested in the places where they can try to secure the lives of their Americans or their allies in the Iraq. The people welfare must be on the back burner. That's why they did not invest on a power infrastructure. If they wanted to, they can use the Iraqi fossil fuel to generate the electricity. They can use that because for Iraq, it would be cheaper and it would be easier to have it. And that's why they did not invest on that. It clearly shows that they did not invest on the people-related projects. Rather, they tried to invest on the projects which they have their political or the security or the geopolitical significance. They ignored, and as a result, the people are paying the price now. Now Iraq have to import the gas, and they also have to import the power. So that is badly impacting their economy. If you are saying, so they destroyed. Yes, they did it on the purpose. That is always a model of American or the Western model. Go for the destruction, then get their contracts to rebuild it and get the money. During the destruction, they make sure that there will be no opposition. They want to also eliminate all other competitors from the market.
The electricity crisis in Iraq is so severe that recent disruptions to gas imports from Iran caused power outages that hit even its oil production at Rumaila, the country's largest oil field. What the U.S. wants is not for Iraq to stop buying electricity from Iran, punishment in itself, but to cut any revenue that Iran makes off of Iraq, which includes trade, no matter what the cost. I'm Kiarash Punemati, and I'll see you next week.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
By facilitating the wave of airstrikes, arming and funding the Zionist regime, just like his predecessor Joe Biden, Donald Trump has once again proven that he is indeed a warmonger. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, the sheer intensity of missile strikes and deadly bombings across the besieged Gaza Strip not only marked the settler colonial regime's continuation of the genocide of Palestinians, but also a decisive rejection of the ceasefire it had agreed to go. The child-murdering regime's criminal leadership, particularly Benjamin Netanyahu, who is on the International Criminal Court's wanted list, has sought every pretext under the sun to resume massacring innocent civilians in Gaza. Despite the so-called lull during the first phase of the ceasefire, the Israeli regime had been itching to shed more Palestinian blood, adding to the tens of thousands of martyrs since October 7, 2023. Overnight, while displaced Palestinians subjected to the Zionist regime's inhumane blockade of food, fuel, medication, and other essentials, were preparing suhoor meals in makeshift plastic tents and bombed-out buildings during Ramadan, Netanyahu unleashed another wave of terror upon them. Within minutes, more than 400 civilians were killed, mainly women and children. Over 1,000 more were injured, with no means for medical treatment. Reports indicate that the current military strikes are deadlier and broader in scale than the ongoing drone attacks Gaza has suffered, while Netanyahu repeatedly violated the original ceasefire terms. In response to this aggression, the Gaza-based resistance movement
The Palestinian resistance movement of Hamas condemned the Zionist regime for disregarding its obligations and overturning the truce agreement. Israel, which has repeatedly violated the ceasefire that took effect on January 19th, sought to fabricate new terms to justify blowing up the deal entirely. Journalist Jeremy Schill of Drop News and Abu Bakr Abed of Press TV noted that since January, Netanyahu had waged a campaign of sabotage and provocation, openly violating the agreement by obstructing and outright blocking aid deliveries into the Gaza Strip. Although food and other supplies were permitted during the first 42-day phase of the deal, the Zionist regime refused to allow nearly all 60,000 mobile homes and admitted only a fraction of the 200,000 tents into Gaza. While Netanyahu has attempted to blame Hamas with fabricated charges of undermining the ceasefire, the reality is that the Israeli regime imposed a total blockade on any aid, including food and medical supplies, to the Strip, and resumed its policy of using starvation as a weapon of war. Recently, the Israeli regime also cut off Gaza's electricity supply, forcing a major desalination plant to drastically reduce water output, severely limiting drinking water for 600,000 people in Deir al-Balah and Khan Yunis. Hamas has remained committed to the agreement and was eager to maintain it, but Netanyahu, looking for a way out of his internal crisis, preferred to reignite the war at the expense of the blood of our people, Hamas stated. According to Haaretz, Qatari Prime Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani demanded immediate international action to force Israel to implement a ceasefire, abide by the agreement, and return to negotiations. That a key mediator is directing demands solely at Israel confirms that, contrary to Netanyahu's claims, Hamas has not violated the agreement. The other side has. This is further reinforced by media reports that families of Israeli captives in Gaza have denounced their own regime, not Hamas. Indeed, Netanyahu's right-wing terror thugs Itamar Ben-Gavir and Bezalel Smotrich not only welcomed the renewal of scorched-earth policies, but gleefully admitted the plans were prepared weeks ago. Ben-Gavir is now set to rejoin the cabinet. Their excitement over the slaughter of innocent mothers and babies reveals more than mere approval. It confirms that Israel never intended to honor the agreement and deliberately plotted to blame Hamas as a pretext for ongoing savagery in Gaza. Since the ceasefire began 60 days ago, the Palestinian resistance and rights organizations have meticulously tracked Israel's repeated violations, as reported by the Palestinian prisoner network, Samedun. At the same time, in order to protect their people, the resistance has not once violated the ceasefire agreements nor retaliated against the Zionist war criminals. Ezzat Ar-Resher, a founding member of Hamas Political Bureau, reacted, stating, "The enemy will not achieve through war and destruction what it has failed to achieve through negotiations." Trump's greenlighting of Israel's bloodbath makes him directly culpable for a series of war crimes, including genocide and ethnic cleansing. By facilitating the wave of airstrikes, arming and funding the Zionist regime, just like his predecessor Joe Biden, Donald Trump has once again proven that he is indeed a warmonger. Israeli activist Alon Mizrahi captured the devastation of this renewed genocide, immediately followed by harrowing images, as a tsunami of shock disbelief and pain. He put it in these words, quote, "Let's allow these feelings to crystallize into even a stronger resolution and conviction," unquote.